This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have more trails that are opening up, expanding here in Northwest Indiana, and there are a lot of things coming in part with the State of Indiana's Department of Natural Resources Next Level Trails Program. We'll find out about those now. We have with us from the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission office, Mitch Marloga, who's the NRPC Chief Transportation Planner, and he covers a lot in his job dealing with trails. And Mitch, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, tell us, for people that are not familiar, first here, what the DNR has planned with this Next Level Trails Program.
Yeah, Next Level Trails is a program that was instituted by Governor Holcomb a couple years back. It infused the largest state investment in trails in the history of Indiana. $90 million was set aside at that time for about three rounds of applications. And it was set to expire last year. COVID had other ideas, and so we're having the final round this year. But with that COVID money coming through nationally through President Biden's initiative, the state received $3 billion, and the legislature just carved out another $60 million. So in all, there'll be $150 million invested throughout the state by the end of 2022.
Now, how many of these projects for trails or extension of trails are here in Northwest Indiana right now, and some of the newest ones that have already come about?
Yeah, we've had several Next Level Trails awards here in Northwest Indiana, primarily along two of our visionary corridors. We have two major trail corridors here that are of state interest, the one along the lakefront, which is the Marquette Greenway Project, and that's received, I believe, three grants. And then the Veterans Memorial Trail / Great American Rail Trail, which kind of cuts diagonally through our region, comes up through Hebron and Crown Point. Hebron received a grant and finished their trail last year through Next Level Trails funding. And then Schererville received money, as well as Crown Point, the last couple of cycles, finished the Pensacola Greenway all the way through its length from Calumet City all the way to Crown Point, and that should be complete by 2023.
I understand these latest ones that have just been announced here from the DNR in Indianapolis talks about a couple, as you said, one of them is a part of the Marquette Greenway, and the other one is, I guess, a new trail or a separate trail in Portage. Will you first fill us in on what the town of Burns Harbor has plans for the Greenway?
Yeah, certainly. Burns Harbor is a kind of the little community that can. I mean, they have been able to secure funding for the entire length of the Marquette Greenway through their community. I believe the entire length could be in the vicinity of about 4 miles when it's all said and done. And they did receive a grant to finish the trail from State Route 149 going west to the Portage jurisdiction line, which is in the Salt Creek vicinity. And I'll also jump on there, Chris, and say that the Portage Project is also the Marquette Greenway. Mm-hmm. It is going to take the trail over Salt Creek. It is a bridge project primarily to get over Salt Creek and to get to the Ameriplex property. People know that primarily because that's where Bass Pro Shop is located, right along the highway. And the trail has just been finished there. We actually had the city of Portage finish their segment of the trail through Ameriplex. So everything's lining up wonderfully to have these two gaps, both, you know, between Burns Harbor and Portage, connected next year at this bridge.
I know it's surprising that some of this work happens pretty quickly, but I guess if you have enough planning done ahead of time, that once funds are available, you can get right to work, can't you?
Yeah, well, it depends where the funds come from, too, Chris. Yes, planning is very important up front, and that communities actually locate trails on their planning documents. But then when money becomes available, it just depends where it comes from. Usually you can spend down state money much faster and usually much cheaper than you can with federal money. People still need the federal money because projects are, you know, many projects are just too much for their own local coffers to handle. So they go through the rigmarole of the time needed because of the permitting and the environmental work and all the other hoops and ladders federal money comes with. But state money is a lot less restricted. And so projects like I mentioned beforehand in Hebron, I mean, they were awarded 1 year, and within the year they had their 1 mile completed just because, again, it was the state funding.
What other communities are planning to or are trying to plan to become a part of the Marquette Greenway system?
The Marquette Greenway Network is a 15-community endeavor from Chicago, the very south part of Chicago, to New Buffalo, and crosses the three states at the state line. And pretty much all the communities right now are in support and on board. There are a few that we are working with to get the trail done. It's a 60-mile corridor. and over 30 miles has been completed or funded, fully funded. So NERPC, we are looking to apply for a federal grant next week to finish the trail. We have done this previously, but the Trump administration wasn't focused on trails. They were focused more on highways and rural projects. So with the new administration, we're hoping to have a new focus back on non-motorized facilities such as trails. And so we hope to get the rest of the trail completed through this grant and finish the remaining about 29 or so miles that are remaining on the project. And I believe our ask is going to be in the $20 million range to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. I know that some of the trails are more clear cut, I guess. There are residents and organizations that are very supportive of it. And there are some trails I know in some communities that are a little contested right now. And I think one of them is supposed to have a town meeting this evening, I believe, to take up the issue of the expansion in their, at least in their community, of the trail, Marquette Greenway. And one of them is the community of Ogden Dunes. What's the status with them, and what are the likely, what is the likelihood, maybe I should say, that it's going to make it through?
You're correct. Ogden Dunes, there are many residents that are kind of going both ways. You know, you have people that live along the proposed corridor that are against it for the most part, and then people throughout the community for the most part are in support. And this is the dynamic I see pretty much when a new trail is introduced in any community, not only in this region but nationally. They all come out on the front end and they're all very very cautious about it. They kind of fear the change issue. They don't know what's coming on, and they kind of embellish the problems, unfortunately. You know, they think this is going to happen, like crime, or there's going to be all this traffic and all this loitering and all this trespassing. When the trail goes in, though, Chris, every time it happens, these same detractors turn around and become the supporters and actually like the trail. They're great neighbors. They're actually increasing property values. And so we see this dynamic play out time and time again. And in Ogden Dunes, they don't have a trail, so it's all new to them, and they're just, at this point, it's one of those deals where it's something new coming down the pike. And my feeling is they're going to, I think, generally support. They say they support the trail, but not in their backyard. So this is the argument they have. So it's like, okay, well, you do support the trail, so we will work with you on a corridor. Hopefully it is the existing abandoned rail corridor, because it makes the most sense and it makes the cleanest connections for the community. But we want to still work with them to make it happen so we can connect Ogden Dunes to this larger network, because it is about getting people on this trail and helping them to experience the beauty of our region.
I understand in this case in Ogden Dunes that people aren't using what's available out there now. As you mentioned, it's an abandoned railroad corridor that Indiana Harbor Belt used to have tracks on. And it's a good walking trail, I understand. This would just make it, I guess, not only more official, but it would also probably make some major improvements to it, too, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, yes. When we see abandoned railroad corridors, Ogden Dunes is a little different because they were able to reclaim that property, and they do use it as a nature trail. It's a walking trail right now, but with a paved surface, now you're going to be able to have all sorts of non-motorized users use it a lot more effectively, a lot safer. I mean, you can't use road bikes on it right now. Wheelchairs have practically a very difficult time using it. So, and disabled people, and again, children on tricycles, I could go through the list. And now they're going to have this safe, paved, off-road path, non-motorized path away from traffic to recreate and enjoy, and to connect the places east and west right now to the national park and other places beyond that they want to go to.
I understand that the issues in this particular case in Ogden Dunes are not unusual. And you've seen a lot of these, I'm sure, in planning the trails through Northwest Indiana, as in your job with NERPC. That I guess that people have to take a look at it maybe two or three times before they decide it's going to be worth the effort to make it an official trail, rather than either just nothing, just abandoned right of way, or some other kind of walking trail, like in this case.
Yeah, I mean, there are people, there are people on all sides of the fence. You know, there are people that support it, and then people that will never like it no matter what happens. And then there's most of the people are in the middle there that do need some convincing. But again, as I said before, the tractors are probably going to remain that way until it's built, and then it's in, and then they're going to be very supportive. We saw that on the Prairie Duneland Trail just south of Ogden Dunes when they did that in Portage. People came out very strongly against it. The same thing with the Erie Lackawanna and Hammond. Now these are two treasured facilities in their communities, and both communities have desired even more trails because they understand they're good neighbors and they want to see them proliferate through their communities. And I would only hope that the people in Ogden Dunes who are against it will come around to see the benefits.
Are there any other, you've mentioned some of the projects that have happened already, of course, the expansion of trails and new trails that are being built and some help that has come from the state of Indiana to help make those trails become reality, and some of the ones that are underway. Are there any others that are out there in planning stages or at least in the discussion stages about expanding the trail system in northwest Indiana, and Lake and Porter counties in particular?
Yeah, Lake and Porter, we're trying to continue on with initiatives such as probably the largest one in Porter County is the Dunes Kankakee Trail from the Dunes State Park all the way down to the Kankakee River. We've been working with Indiana Dunes Tourism and the communities along the way to make that happen. Again, you're talking about a corridor that doesn't exist in the sense of like an abandoned railroad or utility corridor, so we're just kind of making it up as we're going along here. We are trying to use the State Route 49 corridor to make that work. In LaPorte County, there's the Lincoln Memorial Trail, which is a corridor more or less hugging the old Monon line. And within the State Route 421 corridor, we've had talk in the city of LaPorte to actually expand the Chessy Greenway or the Chessy Trail from their community up to and into New Buffalo, because that's where the abandoned corridor does work too. But they also have a lot of interest in getting to Michigan City. So that might start, generating some interest as well. And then trying to get the Marquette Greenway connected east into the South Bend vicinity is also one of our talking points, especially with our sister MPO MACOG out in that region.
I was going to ask what kind of cooperation you get from some of the other organizations in northern Indiana in particular to help expand, in this case in particular, the Marquette Greenway has expanded from Illinois across and into head to Michigan.
Getting local support and getting different people and different entities on board has never really been an issue. Trails sell themselves, and being in this position and working on these projects as long as I have, it's great to see. It took some time to get to that point, but the Rails to Trails movement has been flourishing for the last 30 to 40 years, and it's just gaining more and more momentum. Again, when people see these facilities on the ground, when they get out there and experience them, they understand that they want them for themselves. And then entities throughout our region are really chopping at the bit to expand the network into their own communities. I recently moved here to Dyer, here on the state line, and we have a great opportunity to connect to the Pensee Greenway, and there's a lot of interest to make that happen, to come into Dyer and connect to our Central Park here in this community. And when we work with entities, especially with the Marquette Greenway, Chris, this is a large regional initiative. One region, and one region, which is this initiative by the Northwest Indiana Times, they have turned the Marquette Greenway into one of the top three initiatives in this region behind the airport and the South Shore expansion. Mm-hmm. So it has reached the radar of people who understand the amenity that it is and the economic engine that it can be, the attraction it can be, the tourism interest that it will provide for this region. And again, just the enormous benefits that it will provide to the residents that live along the corridor, no matter where they are built. So, again, there's been a lot of great projects built throughout the country and throughout the state and in this region. And the more people see them, the more people want them. So it's an easy sell, and entities are willing and ready to work with us on them.
Now, Mitch, is there a website or websites that people can go to if they'd like to find out more, certainly about the trails that we've talked about here today, but about ones that are in the planning stages or ones that maybe are being considered?
Yeah, certainly. NERPSI.org, we have a page that the Greenways and Blueways page, and on that page, they can look at our plans about what we're looking to do in this region for the next 5, 10, 20 years. But we also have a PDF copy of our bike map, our Greenways and Blueways map, which identifies all the routes, not only bike, but hiking and paddling throughout the three-county region and into Illinois. That PDF is on our website. And also, we post frequently on our Greenways and Blueways Facebook page. That's where we post updates of trail projects that are happening, events that are taking place, any news that is coming down the pike about new trails that have been either funded or, you know, going to be built imminently. And so we keep people focused in there, and we do have a good following, and we're hoping more and more people will tag along and, you know, continue to grow with us in this region.
Thank you very much, Mitch, for bringing us up to date on some of these trails, the ones that have just gotten expansion and ones that are being considered out there. And we hope that you can have updates for us again soon on some more of these trails here in Northwest Indiana.
Would love to, Chris. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, Pierogi Fest 2021 is coming. Yes, even though there was a one-year hiatus because of the pandemic, it will be back in the community of Whiting. And actually, it's going to stretch from the Robertsdale neighborhood and Hammond into Whiting. And to tell us all about not only the parade, which is coming up first, of course, that's going to be on July 23rd, but the Pierogi Fest 2021 itself, we have from Whiting, Mr. Pierogi. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Absolutely, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, at least give us some thoughts, if you will, and talking with your colleagues in organizing this event as about the opportunity to kind of come back, I suppose, into what we'll have to call the new normal.
And it's funny that you say that, because the theme of this year's Pierogi Fest is the return to abnormalcy.
Mm-hmm.
And we totally understand that there are a lot of concerns out there. We understand that we're kind of coming back from this global pandemic, but we're also ready to party. We kind of had that time where, you know, we just need to kind of regroup, come out of our shells, and just kind of enjoy life again. So we're trying to do it as safely as possible. The new fest itself is a little bit smaller. We're kind of spreading things out a little bit more, which is a lot of fun. We're going to be having some events kind of stretched all throughout the city. Where would you want me to start, Chris? We have so much to talk about. We've got the parade. We've got all the food. We've got the bands. We've got our sponsors. Where do you want to start?
Okay, well, let's start first with the parade. That comes up first on July 23rd. And then we'll get into how things have changed that people, when they come on to 119th Street in Whiting, will see. Let's go first with the parade itself coming up.
Absolutely. Well, if you've been to the Pierogi Fest before, you know that our parade usually starts at Clark High School and comes all the way through downtown Whiting, and that ends at New York Avenue. We are changing that route. We are working with the city of Hammond, and we're incredibly excited about our partnership and their sponsorship of the parade. The route is going to start down by Forsyth Park, which is just a little bit west of Calumet Avenue on 119th Street. It's going to run down 119th Street, and it's going to end at Atchison Avenue. And we're doing that for a couple of different reasons. Number one is we want to make sure that people actually enjoy the parade this year by spreading out a little bit more. So by kind of pulling it from the standard area of the fest, it allows people to spread out a little bit more. We can kind of pack a little bit more people in at the same time. Because one of the issues that we've had in past years is by coming down that main route, all of our food vendors, everything kind of gets smashed in. So we want to make sure that you can see the parade, that we have as many people out as want to come see the parade. And it makes it nice and easy for everybody else while being as distant as possible.
Now, when you organize a parade like this, to spread it out literally to make it more certainly a bit safer for everybody to show up, because you know that you're going to have an awful lot of crowds. Won't be the tens and tens of thousands of people on one particular day for the multi-day fest, but it's still going to be a lot of people. And I'm sure that because everybody's so anxious to see the parade, to see you, Mr. Pierogi, and Ms. Punchke, and the Bouchas who are going to be out there, I'm sure. And it's going to be one of these days that the parade itself, you know, it's always entertaining, but it's going to be even more entertaining this year, won't it?
I would think so. I think, you know, the amount of floats that we're having in the parade this year, the numbers are pretty close, if not what they were in years past. And it's still very early. So we're going to have a lot of awesome floats in there, a lot of fun. But again, I think one of the nice things about moving the parade route is that it gives more opportunity to actually see everything. If you've been on 119th Street when we've done the parade in the past, there's usually little pockets of areas where you can see the parade. But most of the time, you're standing right by the food vendors. So you're literally 2 to 3 feet away from the parade. So you don't get the full effect of its awesomeness. So by being able to kind of spread it out and take it back, you know, to Forsyth Park, it gives us a chance to really shine and showcase with all of the craziness and the abnormalcy that parade brings.
Now, I understand the organizers, in particular, the chairman for Pierogi Fest, Tom Dabberton, has publicized the event as not only going to be an exciting event to be able to watch, but there may be some surprises along the way, aside from the usual cast of characters, if you want to call them that. I'm no offense handled, in this case, Mr. Pierogi, but, are there anything special that we can plan to see on the parade itself on the 23rd?
Chris, here's the funny thing is, these things are such surprises, I don't even know about them. So if you heard something from Tom, you have the inside scoop that I don't even have. So if you want to share some stuff with me, I would love to hear it.
Well, I just heard just hints of it is all I know. So I guess we're all going to be surprised, to say the least here.
I know that, coming back, that there are definitely some little pockets of awesomeness that are supposed to happen. But seriously, they are so very tight-lipped on what these surprises are, that even us characters don't quite know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do know for sure, and it's already been announced as such, that Grand Marshal for the parade this year is going to be Steve Baskerville. Steve is almost, I guess for many, many years, have been a fixture of the parade itself, hasn't he?
Yeah, he is an honorary character. He has been a part of that fest for, honestly, as long as I can remember, and I've been doing this for about 23 years now. And once Steve, retired from Channel 2, we were afraid we were going to lose him. But we have built such a great relationship with him that he makes it a point to come back and join us every year. So he'll be joining me on the float as the Grand Marshal. He's definitely more popular than I am, so I'm excited to have him.
I know in years past, when we've had the full-fledged event in downtown Whiting, that I've gone by early enough in the day. I've seen the CBS2 news people and the staffers set up the equipment up, getting ready for the live shot that Steve is going to do when he does his weather forecast, beaming him back into the loop so that everybody gets to see it. And I'm sure that he's probably more than happy to be able to be as a part of the parade and not have to be working at it.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the fun of the fest, is that a lot of people will come and they have to work it, but you'd rather be, enjoying everything. So I think that's part of the fun for Steve, is he gets to kind of pop in, do his cameo on the news, and then come and enjoy it with the rest of us. So it's low pressure, and it's awesome.
We're talking with Mr. Pierogi about the Pierogi Fest 2021 coming up in the community of Whiting. All right, if you will fill us in on some of the events that people know and love about the Pierogi Fest that they're going to see this year.
Absolutely. Well, we've got some changes this year that we're really, really excited about. The Hard Rock Casino is now the sponsor of the Beer Garden for us, and we're grateful for them. Where Horseshoe Casino is now the sponsor of our Silver Streak Lounge, which is down at the other end over by the beginning of 119th Street and Indianapolis Boulevard. But we've got plenty of activities that are happening throughout. We've got our Polish dancers. We've got polka galore. There are bands everywhere. Mr. Pierogi and the Doughboys are actually going to be playing in the Beer Garden on Saturday night. So if you want to see Mr. Pierogi, rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But we're doing all these fun little surprise things, and it's just absolutely wonderful. At the same time, we're also making sure that we're cognizant of, the world that we now live in. So we're going to have plenty of hand sanitizers throughout that if you need to, you can totally use them. We are backing up some of the picnic tables. We're spreading those out a little bit more so that we have lots of space for everybody. But the food is everything that you know and you love about it. We've got Dan's coming out. We've got, so many fantastic food vendors. It's the return to abnormalcy. We're as abnormal as we've ever been in this abnormal world, and we're incredibly excited to be partying again.
Now, how much work did it have to take in getting things lined up here? And obviously, it was the Pierogi Fest organizing people that did most of the work. But how difficult was it to try to get some of the vendors to be able to come back here? I imagine some of them have been a little shy about coming back. They're used to the crowds, and they're used to working hard for Pierogi Fest in the days that it happens in downtown Whiting. But they know that they have to do something different because of having to deal with the pandemic.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to see, some changes this year as far as, the vendors that you may know and love. We've talked to a lot of them, and a lot of them are very excited to come back. But they are, of course, very, very cautious. But a lot of the vendors that we have that have been part of things have been part of things for years and years and years. And they're also at so many other summer festivals throughout. But I think by the time you get to us in the late July thing, you've at least kind of got an understanding of how this new world works with crowds and festivals and things like that. But honestly, more than anything else, we've had people ask us, are we coming back this year? Are we doing this? Rather than we're not sure if we should come back. I think that you know, the vendors that we have completely understand, and they're excited to come back and party with us.
I imagine they've had to make as many changes as they can. And for a lot of the vendors, I know that they have other festivals and other events they show up at and open up their tents or their set up their booths for. So I'm sure they're used to some of the changes, but have they had to make anything special for Pierogi Fest this year to accommodate it?
And honestly, it comes down to spreading things out just a little bit more. Yeah. We want to make sure that we're not on top of everything in years past. If you've come to a festival, you know that a lot of the time it's jam-packed because people love the food. They love the festival. So we're trying to, you know, minimize that to make sure that we still can invite the crowds out to have a really, really good time. But everything is spread out a little bit more. So the vendors aren't necessarily right on top of each other. The picnic tables are not right on top of each other. There's plenty of sanitizing stations kind of throughout. So we're totally working with all of our vendors and all of our people to make sure that there's a certain level of comfort, but we're also out there to still have some fun.
Now, how about you and Miss Busha and the Punschke, rather, and the Bushas? Are they ready to be able to get back and mingle with the public again?
Very much so. I think, you know, for us to be out there, it's our welcome to really kind of hobnob with all the people that we know and that we love. And last year was very strange. Even though there was no Pierogi Fest last year, I was still out on the streets of Pierogi Fest week and just kind of walking up and down, just kind of keeping the spirit alive. But I know that all of us, yeah, we're very excited to come back and to meet and greet and to see our people again.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great time. And like you say, it's long awaited. A whole year's worth of waiting and anticipation. And it's just one that I think everybody's hoping that will go as well as it could possibly go, knowing that this is probably going to be the new normal for events. I suppose that everybody's going to be anxious to see how well it goes. And maybe because of the changes that have had to be made because of dealing with the pandemic, that maybe some permanent changes in the future, perhaps, as best as you can tell?
You know what? I think so. I think that, again, this is that new abnormalcy. So I think that we're going to learn and see how it rolls out this year, and there's possibly going to be some more permanent things. But if you want to learn anything more about Pierogi Fest, you can always check it out at pierogifest.net, and it'll have more information about everything that's going on and some of the changes that are happening as well.
Well, Mr. Pierogi, thank you for being with us to talk about how the setup is going to be for this new abnormal Pierogi Fest 2021, and we hope everything goes well, and we hope we have a chance to catch up with you here after the event to see how things went as well. Thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Same to you. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Single home sales and multiple home sales here in Northwest Indiana doing very well these days. And let's see how at least we're almost to the midway point for 2021. Let's talk with Peter Novak, who is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors, about it. And Peter, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, how do things look as we get at least through the month of May and continue on through the rest of the year on how home sales have been doing lately?
Oh, it's been unbelievable at the local level here in Northwest Indiana. Our closed sales are up almost 13% year to date through the first 5 months of the year. We have price increases close to double digits, a little bit under 10%. So all of that makes for some pretty strong, substantially strong real estate numbers here locally. It's a little bit different than what we're seeing nationally, and that's probably, again, due to an influx of some buyers from Illinois. Mm-hmm. But we're certainly in a very strong position locally in our housing market.
Well, it seems like, at least certainly for at least the first half of this year, and maybe for years past recently anyway, have been sort of the same factors, hasn't it? It's been people that have wanted to buy a home that live out of state, particularly, like you said, across the state line, wanting to come into Indiana for whatever reason it may be, and they choose to buy a home here. Or maybe it might just be some of the factors that we've seen before in so many other years past that the number of houses available for sale is down, and it's not really grown much over the year, hasn't it?
No, it's gotten worse in this market, Chris. I mean, all of the factors that you mentioned, they're not new factors. They've been here almost for decades, and really even in the last 5 years, we've seen it more so. But in the last year specifically, we've seen an accelerated market in that sense. Inventory is so low here. It is a national problem. Low inventory is a national problem. But here in Northwest Indiana, we have something slightly under 1,000 total homes for sale in a 7-county area.
Wow.
So think about that, Chris. We have 1,000 homes for sale or less, but yet we're doing the same numbers that we were doing in 2000, let's say 6 and 7, where there might have been 5,000-6,000 homes for sale. So, you know, that's obviously a substantial difference in inventory, but yet still homes are selling at a pretty substantial mm-hmm. pace, which means that buyers obviously have very, very strong demand, that prices have increased as a result of that strong demand and limited inventory. And because of that, we're seeing price increases that are fairly substantial as well. And all of that's a good thing. We'd rather have a strong housing market in that sense. But yet, you know, that market makes it difficult for, let's say, for example, first-time home buyers. And affordability becomes an issue, you know, when you have a market like this, too. So there's a flip side of that coin.
Does that seem to mean that the first-time home buyers pretty much have to be stuck in maybe rentals or apartments or the like until they can find something, until something becomes available?
Yeah, I think it really is a matter of them being able to afford only so much, and then in some cases not being able to find what they're liking at that price. I mean, everyone does have a limit, and so obviously everyone's a little bit different, but I think when prices rise dramatically like this, you just get some people that they want to purchase a home, but they're just unable to. And you know, there's not much relief on the rental side as well. It's nice to think that, hey, I just won't buy a home right now. I'll wait and I'll rent and I'll buy a home when things cool down. But, you know, rental prices have been increasing dramatically as well. And so it's just a tough housing market. We'd much rather have a market like this than, let's say, the opposite, which we did have in 2008, where we had a ton of homes for sale and no demand. So this is the extreme opposite of that. We have a ton of demand and not so many homes for sale. One of the trends we are starting to see this year is we are starting to see that sellers are coming back into the market just a little bit. The problem with that is that it's not proportional to demand at all. So, you know, is that a trend? Probably. Will we start to see more sellers come into the market over the next year? Probably. Will it be enough to change, you know, or satisfy demand so much that prices start to cool off a little bit? At some point that'll happen. I just don't know if it'll be through the remainder of this year or not. So I guess we'll just have to wait and find out.
Now, I know that the Realtors Association numbers don't include new construction, but you and your mm-hmm. fellow realtors obviously keep your eyes and ears close to the ground. Do you hear more for these days or even less from the contractors out there trying to put up new houses and start new subdivisions?
Yeah, I mean, that it was my understanding, and I can let them speak more specific to the numbers, but when we came out of the Great Recession obviously we came out of it, but the housing market started to get back on track in a strong way, let's say 2012 on. Throughout that time that we've rebounded to not only pre-recession levels, but then far exceeded those in the existing home sales market, it was my understanding that new construction did not rebound in that same exact way, mm-hmm. Not nearly as strong as existing home sales. I think there was a couple reasons for that. I know labor at some point was an issue for a lot of the builders. In other words, they would build more homes if they could, but they were constrained by things like labor. I think that's still the case today, where they would build more homes if they could. But, you know, there's things like construction, lumber availability, and other materials that are causing some constraints, and even the prices of new construction has shot up dramatically just due to the cost of materials. So they have their own, you know, issues to try to work through, but I'm quite sure that there are more new construction homes, you know, on the market today than there was a year ago or even 5 years ago. But it's, again, even from their point of view, it's not nearly enough to satisfy the demand that we're seeing in the housing market. It really is something that I think we'll look back on Chris, and say that was just really some crazy times. It really is unprecedented. We've not really seen numbers the way that we've seen them in the last year.
Now, looking ahead, it's difficult. We never know how the trends are going to be, but certainly you get a good indication, I suppose, from the first half of the year at least, or almost looking to the rest of the year. Does it look like it's going to be just as heavy as far as demand is concerned, that it's going to be a seller's market all the way through 2021?
Yeah, I think it'll take some time to correct that. So I think we are anticipating that. I know inflation was reported to be high, and there was concern whether the Fed Reserve was going to raise interest rates, because obviously part of what's driving this high demand right now is money is cheap. Interest rates are historically low. Again, we'll look back on a time like this and probably be amazed when we're paying something higher. But I think if those remain low, we will continue to see a strong, housing market. I know that from what I've understood, the Fed thinks that the inflation number that was reported over the last year was, a lot of it was temporary. And so I think they've indicated that they'll raise rates at some point in the future, but not necessarily in direct response to what they're seeing in inflation. And I guess that remains to be seen. But I think as long as interest rates remain anywhere near the levels they're at right now, even if they increase a little bit, we'll continue to see a pretty strong a strong seller's market and high demand for at least the remainder of this year.
So. Peter Novak is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And as always, Peter, thank you for joining us with your insight and looking at the numbers on how the home sales have been here in Northwest Indiana, certainly going into the middle of the summer and the rest of the year. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
How easy is it to find help for a child who has a mental illness? Not very. There are lots of barriers to getting treatment, and that's a nightmare for families. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett speaks with a mother who watched her son's illness worsen while they fought to get help.
Meg Hartz is sitting on the end of her sofa, what she calls her command center. It's in her South Bend, Indiana home, where she spent years trying to find mental health care for her son.
This is him. This is his grandpa, and he would love to go up to grandpa's cabin and do any woodworking that grandpa was willing to help.
In an album on her phone, Hart stored smiling photos of the 16-year-old she describes as kind and compassionate. She says this is the real him, not the depression that keeps him in bed for hours or the mania that leaves him awake for days.
But when he's manic, they don't see that. They think, oh my gosh, he's 6 feet tall. He's a big kid. He's going to hurt me. And he's not. So yeah, that's my fear, is that people won't understand him.
She fears his illness could lead to a dangerous confrontation with others, like the police. We're using his middle name, Christopher, to protect his privacy, partly because of the stigma around mental illness. In fifth grade, Christopher was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. When his condition worsened, Hartz quit her job and homeschooled him while they sorted out his medication.
In reality, I became his caseworker. So I was the go-between between the therapist, between the psychiatrist, between the occupational therapist.
For 4 long years, she struggled to find comprehensive treatment. The family dealt with provider shortages, waiting lists, trips to the ER, and spiraling costs, at least $5,000 a year. All the while, Christopher's condition deteriorated. That's a common problem because America's mental health system is overwhelmed, especially as people feel added stress from COVID. CDC data shows ER visits for children in a mental health crisis rose 30% during the pandemic.
We're in a crisis situation, and now it's buckling under the weight of all of these people who really, truly need treatment.
This is Holly Wheeler, director of Family Voices Indiana. It connects families with resources, and she says the workforce shortages in mental health are staggering. So to receive a serious intervention, like hospitalization, it's almost impossible if a child isn't suicidal or homicidal.
It's very taxing on families. And if you don't have the means and the resources, then I guess you're out of luck.
And people with private insurance can have their own set of challenges. Out-of-network psychiatrists, high deductibles, and uncovered services. While Medicaid offers more robust coverage in Indiana, privately insured people largely can't access it. So here's the problem families face with a child like Christopher.
So if he gets to the point where he is actually violent, he will have lost himself. Why can't we save him before that? Why isn't that kid worth saving?
As Christopher's condition deteriorated, Hartz felt hopeless. It seemed there were only 2 choices left: turn him into juvenile justice as a truant, or give up parental rights altogether. But in 2019, Christopher was able to join a so-called wraparound program where his doctors, teachers, therapists, and parents could collaborate. The team eventually decided on a potential treatment, but Hartz had to convince the state to fund his inpatient stay. She says the experience was humiliating.
I said, you know, what do you want me to be? Do you want me to be such a deserving family that we deserve your funding? Or do you want us to be so broken that you need to fix us? Because I'll be whatever you want.
This year, the state agreed to fund inpatient care on a month-by-month basis. Doctors can observe Christopher and make decisions about his medications and treatment. Still, Hartz has a nagging thought.
I truly believe that if we had gotten wraparound services 4 years ago, instead of having to wait 4 years, he would not be an inpatient right now.
And the family struggles are not over. The hospital staff says Christopher needs long-term residential treatment. So Hartz has started the process of securing her son's care again. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
Our series continues tomorrow as we explore the barriers to improving mental health services. The series was produced by Bridge Michigan and Side Effects Public Media in collaboration with the Institute for Nonprofit News. The project was made possible by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, with additional support from INN's Amplify News Project and the Solutions Journalism Network. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.